nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
As I was mentioning last day, that the general model of transport that we have been talking about throughout this course, said you could call it this elastic transport, which is that electrons go from one end to another without exchanging energy with anything, and then all the energy exchange happens at the contacts. Now, of course, in real big devices, there's energy exchange inside also, but as I said, as I mentioned before, in principle, you could think of a long device as little small devices in series and try to get inside. But in any case, this model is, of course, works very well for small devices. And what you can show is that this model, when you use it, you can express the current as being proportional to F1 minus F2. F1 and F2 being the Fermi functions in the two contacts. And the understanding is that these contacts are big things which are always held in equilibrium by the surroundings. Okay? And in a way, what we did in January, we had a semi-classical model for this quantity. We're trying to write this thing down in terms of particles. And what we learned in February was how to do that from Schrodinger equation. So all these equations that you have, if you used it, finally when you calculate the current, it would still look something like this. It's just that you'd have a detailed model for what this is, would include interference effects, would include spin-related effects, everything. You see? But at the end of the day, you'd have something like this. And as I mentioned last day, once you have this, you could also use it for describing heat flow. Because within this model, the picture is that think of a device with just, say, one level. And an electron goes from here to here. So it appears out there. And that, of course, is very badly out of equilibrium with this contact. And so it loses all this energy and drops down. And in the contact goes out this energy. Similarly here, it's like there's an empty spot left behind way up here, which is out of equilibrium. And so electrons come in from here and fill it up. And so effectively what is happening is electrons are coming in from here, taking that much energy out of this contact, absorbing it from the contact, going through, and giving up that amount of heat there. So every electron that goes through the device kind of picks up that much heat and dumps that much heat. And so if you wanted to write the heat flow, like how much heat current was coming out of contact one, you could use much the same formula, except that instead of Q, I put E minus mu 1. Because the picture is, you see, when I'm thinking of charge current, every time an electron goes through the device, it carries an amount of charge Q. Now, every time it goes through the device, it removes an amount of heat E minus mu 1. So instead of Q, you just put E minus mu 1. And the same equation. Of course, now because it depends on E, it needs to be inside the integral. I can't put it outside here, of course. It has to be inside there. That's about it. And if I want to know what's dumped in 2, well, E minus mu 2. That's it. Okay?
Should the sign not be different for the both contacts? Because you have outflow and inflow of the heat?
Right. So that all depends on how you define this Q. Right? That when I write IQ1, do I mean what got in there or what got out of there. Right? So accordingly, you may want to put a minus sign. Right? But physically, it's clear what happened. This is what got taken from here. This is what got dumped there. Right? Okay. Now, one important reason for being interested in thermoelectric devices, like last day I mentioned that although in general we are talking about electrical devices where currents are driven by voltages, currents can also be driven by temperature difference. Because, after all, the driving term here is F1 minus F2. And Fermi functions involve both chemical potential and temperature. So difference in temperature can also drive a current. And that's of particular interest because it allows you to convert heat into electricity. Why? Because if you had a temperature difference in some way, so this was a hot side and that's a cold side, then the point is it would drive a current. And you could use it for, say, lighting up a bulb or, you know, doing some useful work with it. You could use this to drive some load. So in a way, this allows you, you see, to convert heat into electricity. Now, when you convert heat into electricity, you see, supposing this side is at a higher temperature than this side. So this is T1, this is T2, two different temperatures, and it's driving current through this thing, let's say. Now, what you're doing is you're taking some amount of heat out of your Q and dumping it in there. So you're taking heat Q1 out of one, and you'd be dumping Q2 into the other one. And of course, if this is actually working as a thermoelectric generator, then Q2 should be less than Q1. In other words, the way I have drawn it, it is more like I'm taking something, but I'm dumping a whole lot more, and the extra came from the battery. So in other words, this is not a generator. This is not helping me generate electricity. I'm using up electricity. Okay? But if there's a temperature difference, then things could be arranged, so it would work the other way. This mu2 would actually be higher up here, and current would still flow this way because of the temperature difference. You see? And then you'd be taking more than you dump. And the difference is what would then be coming out from the device. And so Q1 minus Q2, that's what would be your useful work. So you take so much, dump there. And there is this. Now, this, of course, is what you call energy conservation. That energy has to come from someplace. So you took this much from one contact, dumped so much into another contact, and you dumped less, so the rest of it you got as useful work. And that's what you call the first law of thermodynamics, that energy is conserved, that heat is also a form of energy. That, of course, it took years and years of arguments and discussion for people to agree on, that heat is indeed a form of energy. But now, at least, that's pretty clear. And the thing is that the difference is this work. That's first law. Now, there is another law, that's the second law of thermodynamics, which is actually much more subtle. And continues to, even after all these years, it continues to generate lots of discussion. Again, you do a Google search on it, you'll get endless arguments and discussion on the subject. Okay? And what it basically says is that, you see, you could have all kinds of Q1 and Q2 that would satisfy this relation. But what the second law says is that Q1 over T1, so that's the amount of heat I took out of here, from a temperature T1, okay, that should be less than Q2 over T2. So this is the, I mean, in this context at least, this would be the second law of thermodynamics. Okay. And one thing you can see then is that if both temperatures were equal, it would mean you could never get any useful work out of it. Why? Because if T1, if I make those two things equal, I can cancel it. Then basically it is telling me that Q1 will always be less than Q2. What that means is I'll never get any work out of this thing. Because in order to get some work out of it, I have to take more than I dump. The specifics, I think in order for this to work properly, you want to have it, you want to have either an N-type or a P-type situation. So I'm saying, so what would happen is, supposing you have something up there, then when you leave it open circuited, you know, let's say this is at a higher temperature, electrons are going this way, and if you leave it open circuited, they will pile up here and raise the mu2 somewhere here. So there will be an open circuit voltage which will create a situation like this if this is at a higher temperature than that. And then if I put a resistor, what will happen is this will come down a little bit because it's trying to drive the current, etc. But those are details that can be analyzed, and it's fairly straightforward once you have this correct picture in mind. So a good, so let's say we keep this open circuited. Yeah, that's easy. So open circuited means current has to be zero. And since only one energy is involved, I don't have to worry about integrals, it's just one energy. So the way you'd get zero current is if F1 is equal to F2 at that energy. Okay? So now, as you know, F1 is, looks something like this. This should be equal to for open circuit. So that immediately tells you this should be equal to that. And if temperatures had been the same, that would imply mu1 is equal to mu2. But if temperatures are not equal, then you can see you have to have a difference. And you can figure out what the open circuit voltage would be. Now, one interesting thing you'll notice here is, you see, in order for electrons to go from left to right, like I have assumed, F1 must be greater than that, right? In order for current to flow like I have assumed. So what that means is that E minus mu1 over T1 must be less or greater? Less than that, right? In order for current to flow the way I said. Okay. Now remember, this is what we call the heat taken from contact 1. And this is actually the heat dumped in contact 2. So what you can see is that the equation that we're using here kind of automatically ensures the second law of thermodynamics in this context. In other words, if you calculate heat flow from these equations, then you don't have to separately worry about the second law in this type of problem where it works. Because you see, it is automatically ensured. You can see that. But this is part of a much more general principle, and this I want to discuss a little more with more examples for two reasons. Firstly, I wanted to go on to devices where the current does not quite depend on F1 minus F2, but depends on F1 and F2 in a much more complicated way. So I want to go on to a more general set of devices, number one. And number two is that this is really a very deep principle. As I said, after many hundred years, people are still arguing about exactly what it means, how it applies. And this is particularly relevant to energy conversion devices. You know, one of the very interesting applications that people envision in the coming years for nanoscale devices is energy conversion, how to convert heat into electricity, you see? And there are some very deep fundamental principles involved. And of course, the basic thing you can appreciate in a simple way, and that is this. You know, let's say a car is moving and the car has a certain energy, a kinetic energy, and you turn off the engine, it comes to a stop. Where does the energy go? It heats up the road. Okay? It goes into all the molecules in the road, they start jiggling, they take away the heat. Okay? So that's energy conservation. All the energy that was in the car became heat. Okay, now you could envision a reverse process where a car is standing there, the road just gets cold and the car starts moving. Won't happen in a million years, right? Never happens. It would still be conserving energy, of course. You have taken energy from the road and turned it into this. I mean, so no problem with the first law. What's the problem? The problem's with the second law. I mean, the second law would say that won't ever happen. In other words, mechanical energy, which is in this car. So what's the difference then between heat and mechanical energy? The difference is that mechanical energy is all in 1 degree of freedom, namely the car. Heat is distributed in millions of degrees of freedom, like many, many molecules. And the general principle is that energy will always go into more and more degrees of freedom. But it won't happen the other way. Energy from 100 degrees of freedom won't just go into one. Okay? So that's the basic difference. And that's the, kind of what underlies the second law in general. So this whole idea that, and this quantity, Q over T, that's what people call entropy. And again, one of those concepts that raises a lot of discussion, confusion, etc. But what basically entropy is a measure of is all this energy that you have, how many degrees of freedom is it distributed in? That's the essence of it, really. Okay? And the thing is, lots of things in life, real things, are actually driven by entropic forces, namely by the fact that energy is just trying to go from 10 degrees of freedom out to 100 degrees of freedom, rather than by mechanical forces. You know, mechanical forces, of course, degrees of freedom doesn't change. Best example, planets going around the sun. The energy is always in that same degree of freedom. It's not going anywhere. That's mechanical. Whereas lots of things, like why heat flows from hot things to cold things, or why current electrons flow from high chemical potential to low chemical potential, a lot of that is actually often driven by what you'd call entropic forces. That is, because it's trying to go from few degrees of freedom to more degrees of freedom. Okay? And that's what kind of leads to the second law, which is important, especially if you're trying to design nanoscale devices, which will somehow allow you to convert heat into electricity. Okay. Now, what I'd like to consider is an interesting special device, which kind of illustrates this issue very rather nicely. Okay. And this device, what I'll consider is a rather idealized form of this device. But actually, I have a friend in Michigan who has actually done experiments on real structures, which are kind of closely like this. And what they see is roughly what you'd expect from the models that we'll be discussing. But in this discussion, because real experiments, you know, have all kinds of details that take time to get into, I won't really go into those. We'll talk about a relatively idealized device. Okay. Now, the way this device, what the device we envision is something like an anti-parallel spin valve device. Anti-parallel meaning, remember, you got these two magnets, two contacts, one of which allows up spins to get in easily, the other one allows down spins to get in easily. Right? These devices we have discussed. Only thing is, I'll assume that this is a perfect, we have perfect contacts. What that means is, here, only down spin can get out, and upspin cannot get out at all. Whereas here, upspin can get in, but downspins can't. So assume that it's perfect. In real devices, what happens is, it's really not perfect. It's more like, say, 80-20 or 60-40. But that's a detail we won't get into. Okay. So for this device then, you could kind of think of it this way, that I've got these contacts, and I've got I'll draw a density of states here, say something like this. So what I'm drawing here is this density of states, and this is for upspin, and this is for downspin. And by the way, for this discussion, we won't really have to worry about those subtle aspects of spins, you know, like X polarization being a superposition of up and down and things like that. We'll just consider up and down. It's almost like having two types of electrons, red and blue. That's it. You really don't need any of the extra complications at all in this discussion. So let's say we have got these two density of states, up and down. And what happens is that they are connected to the two contacts. And upspin can come in easily from this contact. So they easily come in here, but they cannot get out there at all. So there's no connection to this side at all. And downspins can come in from here, you see? So as if there is a little, you know, so this is like the gamma 1. Gamma 1 tells you the rate at which electrons will come in from here. and this is like gamma 2. But the difference is that this only allows up spins to get in. This only allows down spins to get in and out. Now, the question is, will there be any current in this structure? No current at all. Why? Because, you know, up spins get in, but then there's nothing there. In real devices, of course, what would happen is up spins would also be able to get out on this side somewhat, and so there would be some current. But for this discussion, we'll assume a perfect device where you just connect this way, no connection at all. Now, if inside the device we have some magnetic impurities, you know, impurities that allow electrons to flip their spin. So what is well known is that, let's say, you know, so this is up and this is down. Now, let us say inside I have an impurity which happens to look, say, down. By the way, for this impurity, I'll use a double arrow. For electrons, I'll use a single arrow. These are the electrons that are moving right through. And these are like localized little spins that are sitting there. So in the experiment, real experiments, people implement it with, let's say this is a gallium arsenide channel where electrons go right through. And those impurities could be manganese impurities. Manganese because it's a magnetic ion, you know, where there are separate, you know, there are more up spins than down spins or more down spins than up spins. They're not all paired. So let us say you have a magnetic impurity. Let's, you know, some of them are down, some of them are up. I guess I want to draw an up there. So if I didn't have this, then current versus voltage would have looked like that. And absolutely nothing. In this idealized situation, if I didn't have this. Now that I have this, what will happen is that, see, at equilibrium, you know, this up is kind of filled up to here because it is in equilibrium with this contact, whereas all the down spins are filled up to here because it's in equilibrium with that contact. And now, because you have this flipping process, what happens is up spins from here can interact with one of these and flip their spin and end up there. And this process, this is an interaction I'll try to talk a little more about in the last week or so of this course. And that is, there's the electrons interact with these impurities so that if you have an up spin electron and a down spin impurity, they can interact, leaving the impurity up, turning the impurity up and turning the electron down. So this is what you call a spin flip process. So whenever there are magnetic impurities, it allows electrons to flip their spin. Overall spin is conserved in the sense that if the electron turns around, the impurity has to turn the other way. So you can see then that if both were up, then nothing would happen. So if you have an upspin electron and the impurity is also up, then it doesn't matter whether you have an interaction or not. Up would just stay up forever. Right? Nothing much would happen. So this, nothing happens. Whereas if an up can find a downspin electron, a downspin impurity, then it will help flip it. And so because of the presence of these impurities then, what will happen is these upspin electrons will be able to interact with one of these downspins, flip, turn around, and go out. And once it's turned around, of course, it goes out. And so this extra electron goes out there, goes out of the contact, and the empty spot left behind now gets filled up from here. So that's how current will flow. So what you can show then is that the current versus voltage would look like this. You now actually get some current, which is why actually when people try to make spin valves, they go to great lengths to avoid any magnetic impurities, because any of this kind of spoils what you're really trying to do, because it adds a, you know, spin flip process that interferes with what you normally do. Whereas here, the particular device we are talking about kind of is one where no current would flow if there were no spin flip impurities, but then the spin flips allow you to do this. Okay. Now my question is, what would happen if we arranged it so that all these impurities happen to be up and there is no down impurities at all? So every impurity, we have arranged them so that they are all looking up. You know, I got maybe a million of them in there, but all of them are arranged to be looking up. However, we have managed that, yeah. Say this again. Oh, no energy is needed to flip in this disk, right? That is because, you know, upspin and downspin have exactly the same energy, right? So ordinarily, they would want to be equally occupied. But yeah, so in this discussion, we are still talking of, in a way, elastic transport. That is, no energy is exchanged. Now, in general, you could have a situation where to flip an electron does take some energy, but we'll come to that after this. Okay. What's another question?
Won't they flip back again after they have,
ordinarily, yes. If it was a closed thing, then what would happen is, this would go that way, and then after some time, it would come back this way. But in a device like this, what happens is that as soon as you go to this, this one then goes out into the contact before it can flip back again. See? And this, in a way, is a very subtle point. You see, because usually whenever you describe any process with some Hamiltonian, anything that takes you this way will also take you that way. And so usually those things would tend to be reversible. But real-life irreversible things happen because there are kind of contacts which every time you go there, you pull it away. Every time you go there, you kind of pull it away. You see? Actually, in chemical engineering also, there's a similar thing with chemical reactions. Namely, if two things interact to produce a set of reactants, if you just leave it that way, it will come to some equilibrium. But the way you make a reaction go one way is by continually removing whatever you produce. You see, then it will want to go one way for a long time. It's kind of similar here. So every time you turn here, you remove it. And then you fill it up here. Right? That's it. Okay. Okay. Now, the question is, what would the IV characteristic look like then? Current versus voltage. And the point I want to make is that in this situation, if I put a voltage the way I have shown it, let's say that corresponds to positive voltage, then what is happening is I got lots of upspin electrons here. Will any current flow? Not really, because you see up is trying to become down, but then it needs a down impurity, but there aren't any down impurities, all up impurities. There's no down impurities around. So what will happen is you won't get any current in this direction. Now, in the opposite direction, what that means is, supposing I put a voltage this way, so I actually fill these up to here, then you say I got lots of these downs, and they want to come here, and they can do so easily. I've got all these impurities, I can flip. They can go. So you'll have a current going this way. So you'd actually have a current versus voltage that would look kind of rectifying. I mean, it would be, you'll have current in one direction and not the other. And the reverse is true. You see, if I had arranged them all as downspins, if all the impurities were down, then you'd get just the mirror image of that sort of, right? You'd have something that would have looked more like this. So this is if all impurities are up. And this is if all impurities are down. Okay. Now, this kind of a current voltage thing wouldn't really come out of a simple F1 minus F2, for a good example. Now, you could try to find the exact, you know, in the simple model, we could try to write down an expression for the current. It would go something like this. How would we write the current? Again, let's assume again that the upspins come in here real easily, downspins can't come in at all, and downspins get out real easy, upspins can't come in at all. In that case, basically the current is just the rate at which ups flip into downs. This rate minus the rate at which they go the other way. That reverse, that's the current. So you could just write what that current would be. It would be something like the rate at which they go one way is determined by how many upspin impurities I have times, how many downspin. Want to write how many upspin electrons I have times how many empty spots I have for this, for downspins, minus the rate at which downspins flip into upspins at any given energy. So this is the occupation of upspin levels. These are how many downspin empty spots there are, downspin electrons, how many upspin spots there are. And this process, of course, depends on having an impurity that is up or down. The first one, down. So that is what I'll denote with a capital F. That tells me how many downspin impurities there are. And for this one, I'll denote this with a capital FU. So overall current would look something like this. Integral dE. And then some constant that I'm not bothering to write here. Some constant that determines the rate of this process. You know, that will determine, that will be determined by how strongly these electrons and impurities are coupled. That is what rate this wants to happen. So there'll be some constant in front, not of importance at this time for this discussion. But basically then the current will be determined by something like this. And in our simple problem, we could say that since F up is equal to F1, because I'm saying, you know, this one is very closely in touch with this, so I can approximate F up with F1 and F down with F2, I could roughly, you know, instead of this put a 1, instead of this put 2, instead of this put 2, instead of this put 1. So that would be the nature of the current. That would be how the current would be described in terms of F1 and F2. And you'll notice one thing, that if FD is equal to FU, what would this thing become if FD is equal to FU? You see, because then I can pull this out and it's the difference between those two things. And you'll notice one thing, that when you take F1 times 1 minus F2 and take away F2 times 1 minus F1, what you get is just F1 minus F2. So then it would be like the old form. It's just a, just that the details of how you get that has changed, but then at the end of the day, it's still F1 minus F2. So that's what would happen if you had as many upspin electrons as downspin electrons.
What question is, the constant that you are not writing, is that energy dependent? Like for the spin exchange, depends the probability of the spin exchange also on the difference in energy level between your electron and your impurity level? Or is it, can you exchange like the spin with arbitrary high impurity energy?
Right. So here, it is like no energy exchange is involved overall, right? So the simplest way people write this coefficient is that there is some matrix element that traditionally is written as a J, whose unit is electron volt. That's this. And then that is multiplied by the density of states of upspin electrons and density of states of downspin electrons. So overall, that would then be, I guess, dimensionless. And this is what's known as this Fermi's golden rule. I think in one of the homework problems, I had kind of given you a problem where you kind of see where this comes from. But generally, it's this Fermi's golden rule, which says that the rate at which this processes take place is m squared times density of states. So this is about how you normally write it. And this is usually not energy dependent. So the energy dependence comes from this part of it, right? So here, remember, one thing that I've kept still quite simple, and that is that the interaction does not involve any change in energy. So an electron from upspin goes into downspin, but with the same energy. So it's still an elastic process. In that sense, it's still elastic transport. What I want to go on to next is inelastic transport, you see, where you have the most general situation. Because it could be an electron exchanges energy with a phonon. And so when it comes out, it's at a different energy, for example. Okay? So in general, we want to go on to different energies. But here we are just talking of same energy. And in that case, you'll notice that if Fd is equal to Fu, then this would just become like F1 minus F2. And the basic equations that we have developed so far, that we have talked about, that would take care of problems like that. You'd just have to adjust your sigma s accordingly to give you the right rate of spin flip. In other words, this sigma s would take care of those spin flip scattering processes. Not at all. So that's part of whatever we have discussed. But if Fd is not equal to Fu, then you see you have a, you know, like the example I took here, you know, where I drew these curves, this one and this one, that was with the very special situation when, say, Fu was 1 and Fd was 0, for example. Then the current is F2 times 1 minus F1, which is, of course, not at all like F2 minus F1. It's a very different function altogether. Okay. Now, one interesting thing you'll see here is that, you see, this IV characteristic that I drew, that actually is what you'd get if you use that formula, let's say with Fu equals 1, you know, and Fd equals 0, so I drop that. So if I just take that, take F1 minus F2, multiply it out, plot it, I think you'd end up with a current looking like that. But if you do that at non-zero temperatures, then what you'll get is a curve looking like this. You see? Instead of this one. And that doesn't look very surprising, because after all, what KT does usually is spreads everything out. So instead of having this rather sharp cusp there, because what you would find is that it would kind of get rounded out. But you'll notice one very important point about this curve. What's that? Compared to, say, this curve. It actually has a non-zero current at zero voltage. You see, which, so what it is telling you is that if I take this device and arrange all my impurities inside, let's say up, and then if I just short circuit it, which means with V equals zero, I'll actually get a current out of the device. Okay. And that's what it's telling you. Now, that itself may not be very surprising, because after all, in real devices, you often have traps. And when you put a voltage across it, traps get charged. And then after that, if you short it, you might get some current out of it for a while the traps discharge. So that's not unusual, really. But what's but there you know where the energy came from. The energy came from the traps. The traps stored energy. Here, if you think about it, there's no energy stored in here at all. You know, whether it's an upspin impurity or a downspin impurity, it's all the same energy. So the fact that they're all upspin doesn't mean there's any energy stored. And yet, you're actually getting a current out of it, right? It means you could drive you could be driving some load with this. Okay. So where does this energy come from? Now, if you analyze it, what you'll see is it's actually coming from the contacts. It's actually taking energy out of the contacts and giving you useful work. How do you analyze this? Well, one way to think about it is, let's find out what is the open circuit voltage of this device. So supposing I take this device and just keep it open, what I claim is there will be a voltage developed across this. And what is that voltage? Okay. Now, the way we can calculate it is, let's make the current equal to zero for a given FD and FU. So for current to be zero, then those two things have to be equal. So what that means is FU divided by FD should be equal to 1 minus FD times FU divided by FD times 1 minus FU. And for this discussion, I'll assume again the ideal situation where FU is just F1 and FD is just F2. So I'll write it as FD, I'll write as F2, and FU, I'll write as F1. Okay. So in order to have zero current through this device, your mu2 and mu1 have to be such that that ratio is equal to FU over FD. Okay. Now, what I can do is from this, I can figure out what the open circuit voltage will be. What is mu1 minus mu2? And to do that, there's one little piece of algebra that helps, and that is that, you see, F is equal to 1 divided by exponential e minus mu over kt plus 1. What you can prove to yourself is that 1 minus f over f is equal to just this. So this is something that comes in very handy for a lot of algebraic manipulations. So it's useful to, you know, prove it to yourself and remember this. And the way you can show this is, you see, 1 minus f over f is really 1 over f minus 1. So 1 over f means what's in the denominator. You take away 1, so you're left with that. That's it. So you can prove to yourself 1 minus f over f is that exponential. So what that means is, when I have 1 minus f2 over f2, I could write that as e to the power e minus mu2 over kt. And this f1 over 1 minus f1 would be like e to the power minus e minus mu1 over kt. And so this whole thing then becomes e to the power mu1 minus mu2 over kt. So under open circuit conditions then, for a given F up to F down ratio, you must have this voltage difference between the two terminals. Okay? So that's the open circuit voltage. So from this I could write the open circuit voltage that would be like mu1 minus mu2 open circuit is equal to kt So, for example, then, supposing if I have all the electrons inside here, let's say we have all the impurities inside here, let's say I've arranged them to look up. So, can you tell me whether mu1 will be higher or mu2 will be higher? Mu2 will be. Is that right? Oh, no, the way I have defined this, though, this means F1 is much greater than FD. So this would be logarithm of a number much bigger than 1. And so this would be a positive thing. So I think it would be the other way. Mu1 would be greater than mu2. Right? So what should happen then is it will look something like this. Open circuit situation. And the way you can think about it is, because impurities are up, what it is allowing you to do is, it is letting downspin electrons cross over this way, but it is stopping the upspin electrons from going this way. You see, because anytime there's a downspin guy, he can find an impurity and turn over. But anytime there's an upspin, there's an all upspin impurities around, it can't go that way. So any process going left to right, that's been blocked. You can only go this way. And so what happens is, this chemical potential builds up, and builds up enough till it can stop the process, essentially. And so the open circuit voltage builds up this way. That's what you think. And now if you take that and, you know, actually connect a resistor across it, you could actually, you know, pull energy out of it. Right? Now, how much can you get energy out of it forever? Yes. Right. So that's why what is happening is, you see, if I had connected it, then of course the battery would have maintained a mu 1, mu 2 difference, whatever the battery wants. But this way what is happening is, I'm just not letting it flow up, and so this side gradually builds up. And builds up to just the right level so that all the reverse processes kind of balance out. So that's why you have an open circuit voltage, which is sort of, if you had short-circuited it, you'd have got a short-circuit current in the external circuit. But now because you have left it open circuit, a voltage develops, which now bucks that process, and so between them there's no current. Right, right. That's the part I was getting to. Right after that. So if you analyze this though, you think that, you see, where is the energy coming from? Now, when I'm driving a resistor, what's happening really? Well, an electron comes in from here, it takes this much energy out of this contact, takes that much energy out of that contact, and puts all this energy into this resistor, essentially. If you analyze it, you see, when it goes through the device, it's still an elastic process. No energy is anywhere. But it takes that much from this contact, that much from this contact, all that puts it into the resistor. Okay? Now, will this go on forever? Well, not really, because every time it flips, what will happen is one of these impurities will go down. And then the next one, and then the next one. And after some time, it will stop. Because after some time, it will become half up and half down. No question. Right? But then if you had a million impurities there, this will happen after a million electrons have gone through. Right? But during that process, you are actually taking heat from your contacts and putting it there, which apparently looks like it violates second law, because that's almost the equivalent of taking energy from the road and running your car. It's almost the equivalent of that, you see, because here you are taking heat out of a contact, which is all disordered form, and doing something useful with it. Now, what allows you to do that? Well, that's because, you see, you have started out with impurities which were all up, and ended with impurities which were half up and half down. So if you look at the impurities, what has happened is the entropy has increased enormously. It started with a zero entropy state and became one where it has a high entropy, because there's many of them. Why is it wanting to go from here to there? Well, because if you have, say, 10,000 impurities, there's only one way they can be all up. But there are zillions of ways they could be half up and half down. So that's kind of what drives it. That's the entropic force that drives it. And because the entropy has changed, you're kind of allowed to take some heat out of your contacts and convert it into work, but a limited amount. Okay? And exactly how much that is, that we'll talk about next day. Good. Okay? So let me stop here.